We're scientists. We know that data shows diversity powers innovation.
Yep.
We know diverse workforces actually lead the way in innovative science. And so we just have to keep pushing forward.
Hello, I'm John Fox. I'm the director of the Del Monte Institute for Neuroscience at the University of Rochester, and I'd like to welcome you all to another episode of Neuroscience Perspectives. We have a fantastic homegrown guest here today, Dr. Nathan Smith, who is the Associate Dean for Equity and Inclusion and an Associate Professor of Neuroscience at the School of Medicine and Dentistry right here at the University of Rochester. His research focuses on the brain's immune system and has the potential to shape how diseases such as attention deficit disorder or epilepsy are treated. He has received numerous honors and awards, including being named one of the 1,000 most inspiring Black scientists in America by Cell Press. And in 2021, he was elected to the American Association for the Advancement of Science as a fellow. Truly prestigious honor. Nathan, fantastic to have you here today. I was just, you know, add to that, actually, this time last year, I got to introduce you personally as a distinguished lecturer at the FENS meeting, the Federation of European Neuroscience meeting in Paris, where you were really speaking to thousands of people and gave a fantastic lecture. Your star is certainly on the rise these days. You've had an amazing journey into science. We're going to come back to that at the end. Let's dive into your research first. And now you work on a very specific cell type. You know, when people are thinking about the brain, they've all heard of neurons and they think about the neurons. Right. But you work on another class of cells that have maybe an equally important role in the brain.
Absolutely.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about these cells?
Oh, yes. I work on glial cells. In particular, I work on astrocytes and microglia. And these are two important cells. One is the immune cell of the brain, the microglia, and astrocytes. Well, I call them the stars and parents of the central nervous system because they are not only important for homeostatic properties, but they also are important for informational processing, which is now coming online as we speak based on the new research and the techniques that are being developed.
Right. So this is a cell type that has an immunological function, but it also has a second set of processes where it's actually involved in the machinations of the mind as well.
Absolutely. Yes, both actually. So, yeah. You know, people ascribe astrocytes have immune properties, but microglia is known for their immune properties. But secondly, what we look for in my particular lab is outside of their pathological functions or their immune properties, how they are regulating neural processes. In particular, how the microglia are actually modulating plasticity, synaptic plasticity, as well as how astrocytes are modulating plasticity. But I do have to say that for my thing is I am very biased because astrocytes are at the center of my entire research program and how astrocytes dictate to microglia and microglia will dictate to neurons and vice versa, where astrocytes can also dictate to neurons as well.
Right, right, right.
But all modulating that plasticity.
And if you went back 20 years, maybe 25 years, the people's conception of glia was as like, you know, kind of a relatively dumb
Yeah.
set of cells that were just there to sort of like a scaffold or structural. Yeah.
They were just glue. Most people believe glue. That they were right. just holding the brain together, glue. They didn't have any relevance or any importance. And that was due to the fact that we didn't have any tools to actually measure their properties and see what they're doing.
Right, right. And just, you know, again, like for the non-expert out there, I mean, these glial cells, they're not always stuck in the same place either, right? These guys get around.
Yes. In particular, the microglia definitely move around. So microglia will move. They will basically send out their processes, extend and retract their processes to survey the parenchyma of their environment, basically to see if anything is going on, right? And when they do sense that danger is happening or some type of injury, then they will move their processes as well as their body, the cell body, to that area of interest to help clear out that debris or that damaged tissue.
Right, right, right. And you use imaging techniques to watch these cells move, to look at them operating. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the technologies that you're using?
Absolutely. You know, it's been a long time. Now we are able to look at astrocytes and both microglia in particular using 2-photon calcium imaging, right? And so basically we use these fluorophores called as a GCAMP. These are genetically encoded calcium indicators inside of these cells, which allow us to look at the calcium dynamics. But we also have another fluorophore, which is T-tomato, which is a static fluorescent protein that allow us to watch them movement of their processes and they move around. And so basically in my lab, we can actually look at both. We can look at it in situ or in vivo. Basically, we cut slices of brain and we can image things in real time while the slice is alive. Or we can actually make these cranial windows on the mouse head and actually image how these cell types are interacting with each other in real time as well.
That's incredible, right? And then they, so these are super important to normal function, but they can, yes, they can get off on their own. They can get off on a jag and
you
can end up with inflammation and stuff. So they play a big role in some of the pathologies that are well known to us.
Absolutely. So we normally think of these cell types are working normally under normal physiological conditions, but things can go awry where they become pathological and they could do more damage than good, especially in disease states. And one in particular, one disease that always popped into my mind when I first learned about microglia was at the University of Utah when I was working with Mario Capecchi on a collaboration with my postdoc mentor at the time, John White, and Mario Capecchi looked at microglia in particular, a disease called trichotillomania. And that's basically where humans will pull out their hair and eat it. And actually, most people thought it was just a neuronal disease, or disease that are responsible by neurons. But it turned out to be, it is actually a disease that is caused by microglia. 30% of a very small population of microglia, known as HoxB8, is like they have a special gene that is found in the people who express this disease. And basically, when you take those microglia out, then people will actually the mice will exhibit the same functions, the same phenotype that we see in humans,
right,
and it will pull out the hair and start to consume the hair.
A completely extraordinary phenotype shared by a human and a
mouse. Shared by a human and mice.
On the basis of one subtype of glial cell.
One subtype. And it's like, that mutation, and it was unbelievable because usually we don't see this,
that's
right?
Amazing.
We never could get the, when we create these mouse models, we never could get the mouse models to recapitulate the human disease in its full capacity.
Yeah.
But that was the first time I've ever seen where it does, where the microglia, that you put these diseased microglia in the mice, and they can actually recapitulate the full brunt of that disease, trichotillomania.
Absolutely amazing. Yeah, yeah. Now, how did you get into glia? I mean, so let's go back a little bit.
Yeah.
How did you get into science? When did the love of science develop?
The love of science developed when I was a young age. My mother bought me a little microscope, and I used to catch little butterflies outside and examine the wings under the microscope. And it started when I was little. I was an avid reader and everything else, but I always loved science.
Yeah.
I always wanted to do science. And most of the time, especially my family, was like, oh, you can either do a doctor, but you don't hear about scientists. But,
yeah,
you know, and so I had that dream of becoming a cardiothoracic surgeon or a neurosurgeon.
Okay. Yeah, so but you were really heading off in the clinical direction you were very young, though.
Very young, yeah. Right? And it was all due to Ben Carson's book, Gifted Hands. It was like a book that was passed down to many in African American families because Ben Carson was like a hero to us all. And we read that book, and you get captivated. And I was like, oh my God, I want to do neurosurgery. I'm now interested in the brain. And it all started from there.
That's amazing. Yeah. So you grew up in Louisiana.
I grew up in a great state of Louisiana.
In New Orleans, or?
I grew up, my family is from New Orleans, but I grew up in West Baton Rouge Parish in a city known as Brule, Louisiana, which is, if you translate it from French, it's burnt. But yeah, grew up in Louisiana, in Brule, Louisiana.
You're a long way from Louisiana up here in the
yes,
great northern climes of Rochester.
Oh, yes.
But you have a long history here at Rochester.
Yes.
Will you talk a little bit about that?
I went to undergraduate in Louisiana. That was a compromise I made with my mother and my grandmother.
You're at Xavier.
I was at Xavier University of Louisiana. And then they said, oh, once you graduate from high school, we would like for you to stay in the state. But when you do professional school or graduate school, you get to leave the state, right? So they wanted to keep me close. And so I graduated from Xavier and I came up here to Rochester. And I took a year out from school because during that time I lost my brother and everything else. So I needed some time to recuperate.
Right.
And I took a year out and then I decided to do work as a lab tech in Hisham Drissi in the Center of Musculoskeletal Research. And that was my first taste of a full on-blown research that was not associated with a summer undergraduate research program.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And it was really interesting. I got advice from an old mentor long ago who said, if you're really interested in something like neuroscience, you should do something outside of neuroscience to see if you like it, right? And so I did that. And orthopedics, it was unusual. I was like, oh, you know, I'd never be interested in the bone. you know, I'll do orthopedics.
Yeah.
And it actually turned out to work out really, really well. I ended up getting my first off the paper within 6 months.
Very good. Wow.
And Hisham was a really good mentor. I was his first, basically, you look at, you know, I was his lab tech, but I was also his first graduate student in a sense that we worked really well together. And we got him that as a new investigator, it was very important for him to get those papers out.
Yeah.
And we got that his foundation paper out. It was really, really nice.
Yeah. And that's key. It really kicks off a career too when you get that
really
first authored paper out as a research check,
right. It shows you know, it's like a mile, it's like a threshold and that milestone, right? It's like once you cross that milestone, it's like, oh, it's really interesting. Like, yeah. Like, you know what, I could do this. And literally after that happened, I was like, you know, I could do this. It's not that hard. You hear lots of stories and everything else like, oh, it's so difficult, you have to put in long hours. Yes, but it's this always light at the end of the tunnel, and that pivotal moment right there showed that I could do it.
Can we turn the clock back though? Because I'm totally fascinated. And I think, you know, I think folks out there, youngsters, would be fascinated to know, you know, when you were in school, like, are you from an academic family?
No, I'm not from an academic family. It's like most of my family, my brother went in firefighting and stuff like that, cops, and we had nurses in the family and stuff like that, but no true academic.
Both of my own parents are nurses.
So
that's interesting, right? So and yet your mom bought you a microscope.
That was through persistence for me, because I was persistent, because I was like, oh, I really would like to, you know, you watch all of these television shows and everything else, and I can't remember, I think it was watching MacGyver, and that really set everything in motion. It's like, wow, it's sort of thinking like a scientist, just wanting to, I look at science like putting a puzzle together, almost like you're figuring out a puzzle and you put in different pieces of the puzzles together until you get the thing completed.
Right,
and that's
right,
the way
right.
I look at it.
Yeah. And
even
that
today.
Utility component of it, the MacGyver component, where
you can say,
I'm going to take a piece of sellotape and a bit of this and a bit of that, and we'll build this and we'll just make it happen.
It's all about
troubleshooting.
Right. And I always explain to my students, it's like, you know, research is about troubleshooting. We have to, you know, things happen. We have to pivot on demand and stuff like that. But it's the fun thing about research is the troubleshooting part, because you learn so much doing that troubleshooting.
Yeah,
part.
And so then you went to Xavier and you were studying biology.
Yes, Xavier. Yes, I went to Xavier and my major was biology pre-med.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yes.
So you were still, there was still this thought that I might be heading over in the Ben Carson direction.
Still heading over in the Ben Carson direction, but it was that time in orthopedics that switched it.
Gotcha.
That told me, I should have explained it better, that showed me that I can do the actual science part of it, right? It's not the impossible. Right. And being the first person to like go into science in my family, I was like, oh, I could do this.
Now, let's get back to the family. So when you said, I'm going to go off and do this esoteric PhD business, how were the folks at home about that? Were they totally supportive? Or were they saying, what about that doctor thing?
No, you know, my mother, that's the good thing about her. She was the type of mother that's like, I will support anything you do. Right.
No.
My grandmother was also very close to my grandmother.
Yeah.
So I was very close to my grandmother, and she always wanted to push us to go for our dreams.
Yep.
And she knows, like, that's your dream, you go. And you have to do work 100% harder than anyone else, but I know you could do it.
Absolutely.
Given that fire to keep going and shooting for our dreams. So
important women in your life.
Oh, God. It is so important that the nurturing and the instilled values they lay in you, the hard working until you can, you know, things may not always work out, but you keep going. You keep shooting and keep thriving, shooting for those stars.
Yeah.
And that's one of the important lessons I learned from that actual experience from them. And I always think back, because my grandmother passed away in 2014, and I was like, oh.
Yep.
You know, and I still remember her words. And I remember even as a graduate student, my friends, when I came to Rochester for graduate school, I used to always give my grandmother isms and how, you know, certain phrases to help them overcome certain things. They were like, oh, Nathan, I know your grandmother would say this and I could do this. So, it was just like, it was just so wonderful, because now I go back when we all have our reunion and they come to visit. They always say those grandmother isms, and it's so funny. And I think about it, I was like, oh, that's my tribute to her. And my tribute to both my mother, who is still with us, is to always strive for the stars and always pull people forward, right?
Yeah.
And that's my heart is my, a big part of my drive is looking back at the next generation of the come for us. And I think that's the biggest drive for me is
and
to
the people
make sure.
That, people that raise you up.
Right. And they raised me up.
And taught you perseverance.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Taught me the perseverance and everything else. And now I want to raise the next generation up.
Let's pick up on this theme of raising up other people in the sciences and that. And again, you know, I know that this is literally a cornerstone of who you are as a human being.
Right.
So you wear two important hats here. One is you're a superb scientist in your own right. You're running a lab, publishing papers and doing all that good stuff. But the other piece of your portfolio is in your role as an associate dean for equity and diversity.
Right.
And it's quite purposeful, your return to this institution. But can we dive into that? What it means to be the first black male graduate of a program like ours and to come back now and take on this leadership role here in the program?
It meant a lot, right? It's like, okay, people who look like me have someone they could look up to and say, you know what? If he could do it, I could do it.
Right.
And that is the whole essence of my being. It's like showing people that actually, if I did it, I know you could do it.
Yeah. And going back to the importance of a black male neurosurgeon and a book handed to you as a youngster and how seeing somebody who walks in your shoes tread that path successfully to the very top. It's important.
It's extremely important, right? It's like, I remember, you know, when I got the book from my cousin and I read this book and I was like, oh my God, I didn't even think this was possible. I've never seen anyone who looked like me achieving this goal to get more people who look like me, young males, young women, into the sciences and say, wow, you know, that's a viable option outside of medicine, right? I mean, everywhere I go, when I go out and do outreach in the community and everything else, we always hear medicine, 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 because no one hear about, oh, you can also do you can also be a scientist. You can also touch many lives by the discoveries that you can find in a lab.
Yeah.
You know,
I know one thing you often say this to me, actually, the viewers may not know, but like you and I spend a lot of time interacting and you always say, we have a lot of work to do. Lot of work to do. But at the same time, when you look at where we're at today, how do you feel about it? I mean, are we well on the way? Are we part on the way? Are we getting there?
Hey, John, as you know, you've known me. We got to know each other for a while. I'm a perpetual optimist. And people's like, oh, you're too optimistic. I think we are getting there.
Yeah.
We're definitely on the way. It's more work, right? We can't like say, oh, we can stop now. We've made it. No, it's just more work to do. But I think we're heading in the right direction.
Yeah. One of the things that you were absolutely instrumental in establishing here at this university, and I know it's been picked up at many other universities, is our Neuroscience Diversity Commission.
Yes.
And we have a set of programs there. Do you want to tell us a little bit about those and what they mean and how they operate?
When I was still in DC at my other institution, I got this email from you asking, it's like, hey, I really want you to sit on this. You know, as an alumni member of the university and alumni member of the program to sit on this commission. And I was like, you know what? Yes, I will. Because you've seen a lot of places, and I think this is important to note. You see a lot of places in the wake of the tragic death of George Floyd, put out of those diversity statements, right?
Statements, yeah.
And it was like, oh, it was like words, 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 but no actions. And the one difference between Rochester and the other institutions was actions, and right, the diversity commission actions, and it was like, let's create programming, let's change the narrative and make things better. And not only that, we have the resources for you to do it.
Right.
And I have to say, it's been extremely enjoyable by working, not only working as an alumni member when I was away, but now being a faculty member on the commission, and to help build programs that actually help diversify neuroscience in general, right? We have done a lot as a commission. I mean, the first is the Neuro East program, by bringing high school students from East High into Rochester, give them their first research experience.
Mm-hmm.
That is unheard of, right? It's different from going in and showing people or telling young students, hey, you could be a scientist one day. No, now we're taking them in our labs and showing them, hey, it is very possible. You can actually pipette and do all the things that we're doing as scientists,
right,
and see yourself in those roles, right? The other one is Neuro City, going into minority serving institutions, MSIs, like CUNY, City College in New York City, bringing students who have never had a research experience into the University of Rochester, showing them the true potential that they could achieve, and putting them in labs where we know that they will thrive, because that's a very important thing. Yeah, yeah. Put them with mentors that we know who are interested and willing to nurture this person to reach their true potential. Another, which is a program dear to my heart, is NeuroYes, which is where we take senior postdocs and invite them to do practice job talks, and now we have added Chalk Talks to it, and give them that experience. And we have been very successful in the fellows who have gone through the NeuroYes program have all emailed and said, this has been an amazing program. I am so happy you have done
this. So this is a program, right, to just to clarify for folks, where people who are getting on that first rung of the job market and going out trying to get a faculty position get to practice all their skills that maybe folks from privilege would have picked up along the way anyway.
Those opportunities ahead of time.
That's really, really important.
And it's just a huge change in the narrative. I mean, I've said on many panels, you have said on many panels, the one thing I hate hearing is, oh, we can't find people with diverse perspectives. We can't find them. And I was like, I don't understand. We're not hiding anywhere. We're out there. We have now, you know, Black and Neuro led the way in creating a directory where you no longer have to say, oh, I can't find them. Here they are,
right?
And I think by changing that narrative and removing that easy, which I call a cop-out, by saying, oh, we can't find anyone, well, now we're putting them right in front of you. They're ready.
And making sure that the next generation is much more representative of the population
in the United States and the world, right?
Right, so that not everybody coming through the system looks one way.
Exactly.
And enriching everything in the process.
We're scientists. We know that data shows diversity powers innovation.
Yep.
We know diverse workforces actually lead the way in innovative science. And so we just have to keep pushing forward. The last program that we just had is Neuro to All, where we have the students and faculty go into the community and educate the community about neuroscience and teaching them about neuroscience, and they can go on and teach neuroscience to their families, et cetera. Just spreading the neuroscience excitement across the region, and basically.
Exactly. And what's more exciting than trying to figure out the workings of the human brain.
Exactly.
So a question for you, right? So you need folks like you to step into the breach in the diversity effort and initiative and help us do this. But of course, what it does now is it steals a bunch of your time. Now you've got a job. You've got two jobs. Mm-hmm. And it's hard enough to be a successful scientist in an extraordinarily competitive market with limited resources if that's the only thing you're doing. But now you have this leadership role. How are you thinking about that balance? Because there are loads of people out there who are going to be saying, like, how the hell are you going to manage these two portfolios?
I always get this question, and I actually got it this past week. I always tell people you can walk and chew gum at the same time. But the most important thing is, because I know the onus for diversifying neuroscience or any aspect of science should not be on people of color, women, people with disabilities, et cetera. It should be a collective group working together.
Yeah, this is a crucial point.
Right, that is a crucial point. It's like everyone at the table should be working to change the narrative, should making sure that people with disabilities, people who are URMs, people who are have sexual orientation differences should have a seat at the table. We should work together to make sure everyone is represented and everyone has a fair seat at the table. However, the reason I took my position and the reason I wanted the leadership position is the fact that I wanted to represent people who felt that they didn't have a voice, who didn't have a voice at the table and who feared that if they do speak out, they won't be heard.
Right.
And so I balance it like it's tough. You know, I'm going to be real with it. It is tough, but I do love science. I am still doing experiments. And I know sometimes my students, I tell them, I'll come in on Saturday, we'll train and stuff like this through the week. But it is it's a fine dance, but I manage it.
But there's a vocational street to this, right? This is a piece of who you are, Nate, right?
It is who I am. And also you have to have the resources. You know, I saw like we had institutions will hire people and that person is going to fix all of the diversity problems. That's impossible.
Right.
They shouldn't. Right. But you have now tasked that person to fix all the diversity problems with zero resources. And it's just that person.
Right.
And so when I talked with Rochester about this and set up two stages, I do have a team on each side, that helps out. You need a team.
So you were given the support structure to be successful in both of those spaces.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that, that's not crucial.
I'm not carrying a weight myself. I have a team.
So projecting out like 10 years, 20 years, which bit of it do you want to be known for? When you think about how it's going to go, there's a piece of you that's policy, leadership, and then there's the pure scientist piece of you. You think you're going to keep them both going, or what would you want to be known for?
I think I would have to, I think it would be both, because I think they're both intertwined.
Yeah.
Because again, until we balance it out, until we see that it is a fair representation across the board, because our science would not be innovative if we don't have a diverse workforce in the lab.
Yeah.
And we won't be able to push those boundaries of science, right? So I would rather be known for both rather than having to pick, because I think, I truly believe this in my core, that they are both intertwined.
I totally think that's the case, because one of the things, of course, about being a credible leader, let's say, in the neurosciences, is that you're seen as a credible scientist in your own right. That's what gives you the leverage. It's what gives you the gravitas with your community. And I think it's an important combination. Well, it's been absolutely fantastic to get to chat with you and to hear your thoughts on these really important issues. And it's been a great pleasure of mine to witness you operating and working hard on behalf of people of every background. You're really, really a leading light in the field, Nathan, and it's a pleasure to be around you.
So, thank you.
Thanks for coming on Neuroscience Perspectives.
Thank you for the invitation.